Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today we're live recording on site at Let's Talk About Food Festival at Harvard University. This is the second part of our two-part series at the festival. It is an ideal fall day here in New England, and we're lucky to be joined by two great guests. Today we welcome Jennifer Hashley, who's the director of the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project, a revolutionary program that looks at sustainable and regenerative farming as jobs creation and economic growth for the region, often in need of stimulus. Hey, Jennifer, how you doing?
Great, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
As always, you know, it's great because now Jennifer co-hosts different Sourcing Matters podcasts with me. She has been a guest in the past. I guess you can handle every part of the conversation with your background. So it's a lucky opportunity for us to have you partake.
Well, thank you.
Of course. We're also joined by Ridge Shin, who's the founder and CEO of Big Picture Beef, is leading the shifting the way away from feedlot beef to 100% grass-fed and grass-finished beef, no corn ever. Hey, Ridge, how you doing?
Good.
And Ridge, you are welcome anytime again. You always bring such a wealth of knowledge. We're lucky to have you partake in many of these conversations.
Thank you.
So today we're going to talk about something that's near and dear to both of your hearts. It's going to be around systems thinking in food production. And really what we're looking at is the food that we eat and the vast impact it has. You see that the production of clean and healthy food as a method of remediation to what ails us and to the instability of the planet of a shared and shrinking planet has begun to develop legs in the recent years. We have a long way to go, but we need to get there sooner than later. With the exponential growth of our population around the planet, and two, the onset of modern plagues inflicting more of us that consume this cheap diet steeped in externalities, we need better food for thought, and we need new leaders ready to tackle these challenges. So, Jennifer, if we could start with you, I'd like to talk about a little of what you're up to with the new entry sustainable farming project, spawned out of Tufts Friedman School, and what you're doing with first-generation Americans on the economic development side of farming and regenerative farming.
Great. Well, thanks, Aaron. So our mission really is to train the next generation of farmers to make sure that people have access to land, economic opportunity to farm, an opportunity to provide food security in their communities, and basically to keep agriculture local and regional. We've really shifted a lot of our policies and priorities in this country and globally, frankly, to prioritize, larger scale, very, economically efficient agriculture at a cost, I think. And so our job really is to try to make sure that we continue to lessen the crisis of human talent in agriculture. I feel like we've really economized and grown to a scale where we've been able to remove a lot of labor and a lot of people engaged in agriculture. Now we have less than 2% of the American population involved in food production.
Yeah.
And so that knowledge base that, we're two or three generations out from people growing up on farms and understanding, the natural rhythms, what it's like to live from the land and be connected to the soil and to each other in community has really declined. And so my big goal in life, I guess, is to make sure that we have we can sustain the knowledge base from one generation to the next, that people understand how the ecological systems work, how can the economic system value regenerative agriculture and food, how can we build that back into our social fabric as we become so disconnected from one another. I think food is obviously something that connects people, and so if people can understand and appreciate how it's grown, how people are treated along the supply chain, both ecologically, socially, and environmentally. I think that's what we're trying to do, is make sure people still have the skills and business models and capacity to grow food.
Well, and it's we have to start with employment. If we don't have the people that are going to raise and produce this higher quality food, we're kind of at a false starting point. We've got to get to a point where we got the right knowledge share, the right producers. And I think the statistic that has been thrown around maybe for 10 years is that the average age of the farmer in the U.S., despite being 2% of the workforce, is over 60 years old. I guess with that stat being 10 years old, maybe they're over 70 years old at this point, right?
So we're still waiting for the 2017 census.
We're getting on the means of data statistics. That's right. within short horizon here, Rich. But I think that's a key point, because globally, small stakeholder farmers make up the majority of the workforce. There's over 1.3 billion people that are employed in agriculture across the globe. And what hasn't been codified, what hasn't taken into approach yet, is a methodology to move us forward where we are connecting with natural order to raise the food and provide planetary stability and preventative health care as an approach. So, Rich, let me make a statement. I want to set a precursor here in the introduction of you, because we are talking about systems thinking here, and we have an opportunity to take off different links in the chain here and look at that system differently. And on the production side, where you're focused on, so what have I told our audience? That it wasn't the cow that was the problem, but instead the management shortcuts that are causing concerning environmental impact. Properly orchestrated food animal management can actually have a net positive impact on the climate. That's right. Net positive impact. Despite being counterintuitive to everything that we've heard in common vernacular, common sense, it's actually straightforward, and it's a leap more towards natural order, what we were speaking with Jennifer. So more broadly, it's just another example of an awakening to a broader system thinking where we can work with aspects of that natural order. And for us, some of that mindset is our systems, or we look even at very low trophic levels, but we don't put food animals into that approach. So Rich, maybe you can share with our listening audience, what's the holistic practice that you implement with Big Sky or Big Picture, and where do you see it fitting into common vernacular? How can we reintroduce the idea that animals aren't the problem, it's the management of the animals that are the problem?
Right. No, the little saying that says that it's not the cow, it's the how. That's really sums it up. But what is fascinating is when you look at all that's been written about how the cow is the problem, and a lot of what they say is absolutely true. Raising the cows the way we do on range out west, raising the cows the way they do in Australia is a huge problem. It's destructive of land. But if we shift gears and raise them like the buffalo, now all of a sudden we build soil rapidly. We create more biomass above the ground, and we create healthy meat on smaller amounts of land. So it's a big, big paradigm shift to get people, consumers, to understand, farmers to understand. My feeling is right now the big vacuum is, you know, dairy is in New England, you know, dairy is basically dead. I mean, farmers are committing suicide at a much higher rate than veterans. It's a really an extreme situation. And yet we have this land which is adjacent to the markets of the world. So, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Uruguay are bringing food into these markets by containers. And here we have the ability, but it can't just happen. It's a big paradigm shift to go from where we are to park the tractor, get the cattle out, start growing grass, and start grazing grass. So, you know, this is very atypical. If you were to drive around and look at most farms, you wouldn't see a picture like that. But that's what we need to do to raise beef on grass in a healthy way. But really, and again, it's a system thinking. You know, we have a little model that everyone in the food chain has to eat. Now you have a sustainable system. You know, if the microbes have something to eat, the soil's not killed by pesticides and herbicides, the grass is lush and full of nutrients, the cow has something good to eat, the farmer gets paid, the distributor gets paid, the store gets paid, the consumer has enough money. So if the whole, and that system, in the economics of today, it's entirely possible. Mm.
Maybe you can give us an example of how that workflow takes place and why that does connect with the natural system. Is it Is it the fact that these animals are eating a natural food stuff for the rumen?
Right.
Is it the process that they're actually trampling over these practices and re-engaging the soil?
Well, it's a number of things, but the big problem with the conventional system is if you do an analysis of the carbon, it's the grain that's grown and releases carbon when the ground is plowed. The fossil fuels are all carbon-based. The whole system moves to the feedlot, and it creates, you're taking nutrients from all this land and putting it through the cattle. So that's a big problem with the conventional system. This turns that on its head in terms of growing the grass and actually increasing fertility as we graze. The quick story I like is everybody knows the prairies had very deep soils. So how did that happen? So the prairie was perfected and 60 million buffalo parachuted into the prairie? Or were the prairie walking around in this dry lot, the buffalo, and the prairie parachuted in? It wasn't. It was a symbiosis of the large herbivore, the soils, the microbes, the sun, the photosynthesis that created those topsoils. And what we found, and the research now backs us up, Richard Teague, doing the research at Texas A&M, that we actually sequester significant measurable amounts of carbon by grazing with this method. Now, if you just graze like is normal, you don't sequester carbon, and you actually erode, and you oxidize carbon. You put carbon into the air. So that's, it's a very fine point, but what we found is you can increase the biomass on a piece of land threefold in about 4 or 5 years. Huh. Just by grazing correctly. This is a picture of one of our finishing farms in Vermont. And that started out, Mark just wrote, in 8 years, he's increased the soil organic matter to 12.5% from probably 2%.
Amazing.
In a short period of time. The opportunity is remarkable.
And I think the symbiotic relationship has happened, hundreds of thousands of years before we even came around, right? If you look at the American buffalo, right, as a good example, now that we've taken them off the open plains and in the West, we've had a vast imprint of desertification, which Alan Savory talks a great deal about as really being one of the epidemics that will impact man the quickest. And whereas the soil, this living sponge, the skin of the earth, really could be the area that we could bank much of the carbon that we've released to the environment and put it where it should go, which is in the ground.
Right. And Alan spends a lot of his time in what he calls a fragile environment, a desert, dry environment. Where we have the advantage in the Northeast is we have twice or three times as much rain as those desert environments, which allows us to do this much faster.
Right.
And what's fascinating about the carbon, if we get the carbon in the soil, it is a sponge. And if you do a percolation test, carbon will hold about six times its weight in water. Yeah. So you can actually fix the whole water cycle by grazing correctly. Again, it's a very complicated story, but it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
When you, we have a little video on our website where they took a perk test on a piece of land that was grazed traditionally, corn land, and grazed with this adaptive multi-paddock grazing. Corn land, it took 30 minutes to percolate. So you wonder why the Mississippi floods. It's like concrete. It's like pavement. And the extensively grazed land, the way most cattle are raised, where they just put them out there all summer, that was dramatically better. It took 7 minutes to percolate. On the adaptive multi-paddock grazed piece of land, 10 seconds to percolate. So you want to capture the water, capture it with a sponge, stable, and then have it go back off in a normal water cycle. You impact flooding, weather. It's just the potential is massive. But the only way for it to happen, in my opinion, is for customers to understand and vote with their dollars for something that's doing that versus something from Australia that's might be grass-fed, never ate any grain, but it's not.
Right.
Sequestering carbon. And I mean, it's a very complicated story, but that's the hope.
No, I think it's pretty straightforward. As you describe it, you do a nice job describing it. If only we had some kind of a venue where you could get this word out in an amplification, something like a podcast, right?
Oh, my goodness. Let's talk about
wonderful.
Food Festival.
Right. Yes. So, Ridge, I do want to talk more about then the impact on human health of eating this meat when it's actually
Absolutely.
Not in a feedlot environment, when the animal's eating its natural forage, and what we get for oleic acid, omega-3, omega-6. But we'll come to that in a second. I want to return back to Jennifer and talk a little more holistically here on the global agricultural side. So it seems we've defined a pretty impressive efficiencies within producing food in the world, Jennifer. And you talked about this in your introduction. So our conventional approach, which is often married to monocultures, has brought food to folks in need all over the world. We've produced cheap food and as a foundation for really dealing with relief efforts to geopolitical stands to economic stimulus. So what's wrong with it? Why is it a problem? That's just a small little question. Like, you have five words.
Oh, jeez.
You have a minute to respond.
Yeah, that's it. Ridge gets 4 hours.
Okay, I get a sound bite to solve the world's problems. I don't even know where to start with that one. My mantra is that I feel like we should grow food everywhere in appropriate climates and for what the land will bear and the local culture and all of that. And I feel like we've gotten so far removed from that in this globalized system. And you talked about the population increase and this and that, but I feel like, we don't pay attention to some bigger picture issues. We've skipped over investing in a lot of land on the globe that hasn't yet had its full environmental potential tapped.
Right.
Not that I'm saying we should pass, the green revolution technologies on all over the place. Right. I'm not suggesting that, but I think there's still a lot of potential around how to amplify what could be grown in other places with more knowledge and best practices and regenerative practices in that way and tapping that human resource. And then I think we also need to really look at food waste, which is a whole other issue that we could talk about. I was just reading some other statistics about how, we waste almost half of the food that is grown on the planet. I mean, that's not just like the waste of all of the, inputs that go into that. And then, how much more land do we need to put into production if we don't even address that? We keep throwing out these statistics that we have to do more and more and continue to create this economic engine of efficiency and, spread these technologies and green technologies and others, genetic engineering and others are going to save the world. But it's like if we don't go back to the fundamental basics of, the system, as we're talking about systems thinking, there are lots of pieces in this whole system that already aren't working well, that are already continuing to evolve into downward spirals that we're not fixing and addressing and stopping, rather than trying to create new systems. Like, can we look more critically at what's wrong in the existing system? Like, what works well and how do we maximize that? But what are the things that are not working well and changing them? And we have the will to change, or do we have the will to change, I guess, is the question, because it's a lot about who benefits, who wins and who loses. And I think a lot of times people aren't willing to look at people that have the power are the ones that are benefiting, and limiting that power is another system, another whole political system, and all of those systems that we have to talk about.
Need a Venn diagram here, right?
Right.
I think it's interesting from that perspective of you have a much broader audience that has to get to better management practices, and we have taken shortcuts within our food production system at the expense of what? And usually at the expense of our own health or planetary stability. And we've had that opportunity because we've had a buffer, especially in this country, of a bounty of natural resources. We've continued to be able to milk that out.
Right.
It's going to take practices and better methodology moving forward. We can't continue as business as usual. So maybe you could share with our audience, you also are in partnership with your husband. You oversee a diversified pasture-based livestock operation, including Pete and Jen's backyard birds at Codman Community Farm in Lincoln, Massachusetts. So if you would, you do operate a diversified crop operation. You use elevated production standards for differentiated food. A lot of the things that you were just speaking to, you do in real time in your own home farm. So it's really a snapshot in authentic farming, right? It's how do we scale this to a much larger audience? How do we engage, or I'll ask you, how do you engage your local community? And how do you promote those additional values of the food that you're creating within your community to your consumers?
So the interesting place that we're in right now, being at Codman Community Farm, we are a community farm. So we kind of have that built-in platform where people are really interested in the community. It's town-owned land. It was preserved 40 years ago for permanent benefit of agriculture. And you know, we're now the stewards of that land, like we all are wherever we're farming. And so we have this great opportunity being in the heart of Lincoln in this community to share what we do. And it comes through in the quality of our meat. People can see it visibly. It's right there in town. We are managing multiple pastures all over the community. People can see how the animals are grown. They can walk their dogs along a conservation trail and see the broilers moving every day in their coops. They can see the egg chickens on the hillside with our livestock guardian dog being moved along the field every day. The cows are moved from paddock to paddock, in different fields. We have pigs, out on pasture right near trails where people walk their dogs.
Yeah.
So we actually have a homeowner who just has a 5-acre field. He really wanted to have pigs in his front yard. Hmm. So we were like, sure, we'll move them there.
Is not a common request.
Not a common request, but they really enjoy it. And so here we are doing sustainable agriculture on public display. I mean, there's no hidden agenda anywhere. People can come visit the farm. They can see the baby chicks. They can help catch the chicks to take them to the USDA poultry processing plant. People can be pretty involved. We had some twins born. Some calves to our calves this spring, and one of the mothers, the mother of the twins, she kind of hid one of them in the bushes, and we tagged the first one and didn't see the other one, and then she rejected the one that was hidden. So now we have volunteers coming to milk the cow, give milk to the cow, calf every day. That's in a more commercial operation that might not be very sustainable, but it's a great way to engage the community who really understand, what it takes to farm.
Yeah. So it seems like you empower them too. I mean, you empower them to be part of the community, to take a stake, right? They figuratively and literally, right? You get many values out of this food that they can teach their family. They can call Place Matters, right?
Right. Yep. Absolutely. And I think it helps dispel some of the myths that agriculture is all bad, or it stinks, or whatever the myths are. I mean, I think people are a little bit afraid of having pigs in their community. Well, it's like, here's a perfect example of how you can raise pigs in an appropriate way that it doesn't stink. It's not a piggery. We're not holding them in muck and feeding them garbage. We're actively rotating them, using them to renovate the land, to clear invasives, to improve the pasture so we can then plant forage species and bring other ruminants in to benefit from that improved soil and improved pasture. So I think, I think having it be more visible and having agriculture not be this, behind closed doors, which is what the industrial system is. Everything's in extremely climate controlled environments, which makes it really efficient, can get the maximum productivity out of an animal. But is that to what degree, right? Then we create other externalities of having to deal with all the waste. And as you were just describing, the nutrient depletion in one location and making, creating a nightmare on the other. So, I mean, what just happened with all the flooding in North Carolina?
Right.
I mean, people are not talking about how many pigs perished. I mean, those systems have no way of moving those animals to higher ground. I mean, if we're going to have floods in Lincoln, we can just take a trailer and round up our pigs and move them elsewhere, because we're not doing things at such a scale that is not a human scale anymore. I mean, I feel like that's just, we've gotten away from the human. Like, what really is the right kind of a management system that makes sense? And to your point, like, how do we scale this good agriculture? To me, it's not about our farm getting bigger. It's about having many more of our farms. Like, because the management side, like the farmer, like the footsteps of the soil of the farmer or whatever is the best management tool. Like, we need to have this on a more human scale, which is why I feel like we need to have more farmers carefully managing more ecologically resilient plots.
Yeah.
So let's spread that and not, scale for scale's sake.
Very good. And it's a good place to raise a family, right?
Yes.
Yes, of course. So, Rich, let's go back to the consumer side of things and what the value of grass-fed beef can represent.
Okay. Yeah.
I think there is a bit of a misnomer out there. It's definitely become more prevalent. People know grass-fed is there. There's an opportunity. I think they look at it as both investment in animal welfare, the animal living environment. They think the health, there's a healthier animal associated to it. But there's multiple layers here, too, because people also buy organic beef, and that could be grain-fed, non-GMO grain of an animal, but it's not necessarily healthier for you. So what have you seen for consumer awareness around regenerative agriculture or around grass-fed beef, which may be a tip of the spear here for regenerative agriculture? And how do you promote grass-fed beef or grass-fed dairy, any grass-fed ruminant, in your operation to a broader audience?
Yeah, well, again, it's not a soundbite. It's a big, long story. So
we're here. I'm settling in.
So we have all the no's. We have no antibiotics, no added hormones, no mad cow, virtually no E. coli. These are things that are very hard to understand for most people, but mad cow, huge public health issue. Mad cow comes from some human grinding up a cow and feeding it to other cows. In a grass-fed operation, if a cow dies, another cow will not eat it. A pig will come over and eat it, a chicken will come and eat it, but another cow will not eat it. So there's no mad cow. E. coli is one most people don't understand. When you feed grain, you create acidosis in the rumen. And one of the biggest inputs on the feedlot is baking soda. Comes in the tractor trailers, mixed with the corn ration, to attempt to buffer the, just like buffering, attempt to buffer the rumen.
It's like an acid, right?
Right. Yeah. But in that acidic environment, the acidic-resistant E. coli develops. The acid-resistant E. coli. That's the one that's going to kill you. So Cornell did the research. You could take cattle off of grain for the last 14 days of their life, virtually eliminate the presence of E. coli, acid-resistant E. coli, in the gut. So you want to get it out of the spinach, you want to get it out of the hamburger, don't feed them grain. It's pretty simple. But then on top of that, you have all the pluses, so you have much more of all your vitamins, vitamin A, vitamin E, and the big, big one is the balance of the omega-6, omega-3 fats. So a lot of people say grass-fed beef has has good fats and not the bad fats. The omega-6 fats are bad fats, but the reality is both omega-6 and omega-3 are essential fatty acids. You have to have them for brain function. We have to have them. But when you feed grain, you get 10 omega-6 to 1 omega-3. When you feed grass only, you get about 1.2 omega-6 to 1 omega-3. So it's more like eating wild salmon. And the researcher that we work with at Susan Duckett at Clemson University, she can precipitate the fat out of the meat and measure that ratio and tell you whether that animal ate grain.
Right.
So it's like a fingerprint.
And it's a balance that matters, right?
It's the ratio. For human health. So, you know, again, that's all the bad rap that red meat has here, you know, where Oprah got in all that trouble and, you know, it's bad for your heart. It's true if they eat grain.
Yeah.
It's not true if they eat grass only diet. So it's a huge story with tremendous human impacts. And then if you go back down the trail of the grain, you have the soil that you've destroyed, you have the hurricanes you've created, the floods you've created, on and on and on, are part of that system. And then you have these manure lagoons at the CAFO, which, you know, extreme amounts of manure that can possibly go back to the land, which are a problem. You know, they call it a nutrient loading, but you just can't get rid of it. So you have all those things that eventually impact our human health.
And the compounding effect of that too, so when putting animals in a CAFO, a confined animal feeding operation, a feedlot, we also have other systems we're impacting, like our healthcare system.
Absolutely.
Where we have a situation where 80% of antibiotics that are used in this country are prophylactically used within animals to increase stocking density and feed efficiency.
Huge problem.
And superbugs, which I think is the common term for antimicrobial resistance, are now affecting, there's 2 million cases a year. It affects the healthcare system at nearly $25 billion and 23,000 lives, all from shortcuts associated, or not
absolutely.
All from,
well,
much from
right.
shortcuts we're using in our food system.
Right. So what I tell people, just to sum it up, As I tell people, I could stop the flooding of the Mississippi, I could cure the drought in the West, and I could cure human obesity and fix many health care issues. You just have to give me the three states of Illinois, Iowa, and Indiana, which now grow 90% of the land is used to grow grain for animal feed, ethanol, and corn syrup. And you could restore that old prairie with a big herd of cattle.
Yeah.
Nobody's taking me up on it, but it's just there to be done. I mean, if the customers could understand this, everybody says there's not enough land to do this. Well, it's right there. It's being destroyed with our corn production. Ethanol and feeding. So this is the big difference between grass-fed cattle and pigs and chickens is no grain. So the grain, so it's an entirely solar system.
I'll make a few calls, see if I can organize the state commitments.
Thank you.
And Jennifer, since we're just taking the central part of the U.S., let's talk more about what you can do for the rest of the world and the new entry sustainable farming program. So you've hit your 20th year now.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
congratulations. Very exciting.
Yeah, thank you.
So, in your descriptions prior, I think you did a fantastic job of explaining, it is the management practice, and we need more small farmers committed to their place, going back to a methodology, maybe authentic agriculture, more commitment to that. So how would you look at new entry and the intellectual property you've developed or programs that you've developed, the tools that you've developed for first-generation farmers? How do you see that scaling? What if it were a national program? What if you had that kind of funding? Where would you take this, and how could you evolve what we're doing for domestic production? I'm giving you really big questions,
yeah.
I know, but that's because I trust you and I believe
sure.
in you.
No, I mean, I think I would start a little bit earlier. So right now, we mostly work with adults who've come to farm, who didn't grow up in agriculture and decide later, either they're immigrants and refugees and they grew up in it and they come here and they had to do something else and now want to get back into connecting with their culture, or they're young people that maybe went to college for something else, not sustainable ag, and decided this is for me or whatever. I would start, if I had my magic wand, I would certainly be promoting agriculture as a career pathway earlier in our school system. I think it's invisible to people right now. People don't understand that, there's so many ways to be involved in agriculture, not just production agriculture, but all kinds of, agronomy, ecology, chemistry. I mean, all the STEM sciences involved in agriculture. There's social sciences that can, impact agriculture. So it's everywhere. But we don't think about it like that because we're so divorced from, food production. It just kind of happens out there.
No systems thinking, right?
So how do we start earlier showing, not talking about ag as this, dying industry, you can't make any money or this or that, and because it's so impossible to get into. There really are real barriers. So I'd have to wave multiple magic wands, but in terms of what we're trying to do to get more people into this, I'd want to start earlier and build it into the school. And I think we're seeing more of that now, which is a good sign. I mean, we're seeing more farm to school programs, we're seeing more ag in the classroom. We're, as consumers and parents demand some of this, I think, better, healthy food in schools and those kind of changes, I think maybe we'll get there a little bit faster. There's now farm to preschool programs.
Yeah.
So I would start earlier, and then I think we need to do a whole lot of policy work in terms of making land accessible and affordable for people, enforcing antitrust regulation in this country so that we can have fair competition for smaller scale businesses in our local and regional food systems. Just rehumanizing the size of agricultural operations and businesses for one. And then that would give a lot more people opportunities to engage in it. And then we just, have to figure out how to give people the skills and the knowledge and experience and the capital and the infrastructure and all those things. And the markets, I mean, it's kind of the whole picture. It's all of that. You can't just pull, I always say, talking about systems, you can't just pull one string. People always ask, how can we scale new entry? And it's I can't just license a farm business planning course curriculum and spread it all over, because you can teach people that it's a business, but then they have to get on the land. They have to have the capital to invest in the infrastructure. They have to have the labor. They have to have the market development. They have to have all of these aspects that need to be in place to make it work. And they're not all there. All those things are broken or systematized or industrialized and monopolized in such a big way that one individual person trying to break all those things needs a holistic approach.
So. Right, and the paradigm shift is the big challenge. we're in a different place with grass-fed beef. There's all these cattle that are already out there in little herds. None of those people make any money. Zero. And it's because of the hay they feed. So, you know, we've done grants to show them how to graze through the winter in New England, and they say, we can't do it. But, you know, we can do it. And or we can stretch the system. It's the only way to make money in that. But it's a huge paradigm shift. You go to a farmer and say, come to a conference in June, and we're going to talk about how you can graze through the winter. They say, oh, we got to be making our hay. I said, no, park the tractor. We're going to talk about this. So it's a big shift. But then the other thing is, in terms of scale, you know, we have all these small family farms that, I mean, there's over 600,000 beef cattle born in this region right now. And they all go west to the feedlot. But then the finishing part, where we actually make them fat on grass, allow them to get fat on grass, we actually make bigger herds. So we'll have a herd of 200-300 head. And now we can afford to pay labor to move those cattle four times a day, which we can't do when we have 20. If you have 20 cows, you cannot make, my opinion, you cannot make a living on it. You know, you can make a part-time living, but if you're making a part-time living, you can't move those cattle all day long to optimize the energy in the grass to make them fat efficiently. You can eventually make them fat, but it's going to take you a long time. So by pooling them in a big herd, we actually create, you know, real skilled jobs that, you know, people could say, hey, I want to be a grazer. You know, and if this thing builds the way we imagine, you know, it'd be a whole new category of farming.
Yeah.
It's not driving the tractor. So you got to give up the tractor gene, you know, but
everybody wants a tractor, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, we have lots of work to do, but it seems like it's doable, and we're finding out the approaches we need to take. At least maybe that's the opportunity in the next decade to transition. The succession planning of farming will be in connection. I do want to get a couple questions from our audience here, but I want to ask one more if we could, and it's again another systems discussion, but it's shifting gears slightly. It's really around our pollinators. So pollinators may be the most undervalued workforce in production. For instance, the most used modern pesticides, neonics, which are neurotoxins that operate a bit like nicotine to bees, are causing hive collapse at a rate of 50% of all domestic hives annually in this country. And to give some context to that, one kernel of GMO corn has enough neonicotinoids to kill 350,000 bees.
Wow.
And this is the stuff we're eating. So we have a fundamental problem here. So like water or soil health, for pollinators, will we awake to the impact of the shortcuts we're having on food and planet on health? Our kids, will we awake to that before it's too late? Anybody want to step to the plate and answer that one? Jennifer, I'm going to put you on it.
Oh, man. I think there's definitely been a lot more public discourse about pollinators, which is a good thing. But I think, you know, I think a largest amount of pesticides outside of agriculture is spread by homeowners, right? You know,
yeah.
People buy a lot of things at places like Home Depot and their garden centers and spray a lot of stuff on their lawns, or hire a chem lawn company to come do things, which also has a huge impact, you know, on pollinators and others. You know, we've destroyed habitat across the landscape. I mean, think of all the urbanization and development that we've had, and as farmland transitions without a successor, it usually ends up being developed or further subdivided, and people put in more lawns and
right. the last crop, right?
Yeah. We lose a lot of habitat for pollinators, but I think it's a serious issue. I mean, now I hear that, you know, in the tech world, they're trying to make drone bees, you know, artificial robotic bee pollinators. Because again, rather than solving the systems issue, we're going to just create a technology fix to have little fake bees running around pollinating crops. Because if we don't have pollinators, you know, we will collapse as a human species.
Well, it's all life. So it's the pollinators, which we can see and document, but it's the soil life that we've destroyed as well.
Yeah.
And the thing that's exciting to me is how fast it comes back if you just kind of get out of the way. Like in 3 or 4 years, I've done it myself in Central Mass, a field that was in corn for 25 years with atrazine and just all the worst chemicals. I first planted some perennial, didn't grow very well. We grazed it the first year, the third year we had grass. So the system was able to rejuvenate itself simply by, quitting that practice. And, of course, in that sward, there's all kinds of pollinator, feed and the habitat.
The natural environment. Yeah. Do we have any questions from anyone that wants to ask? Don't be afraid. Yes, please.
I've been thinking about how do you measure and make the case for the work that you do, especially when you're thinking about your neighbors and, those people who might be resistant to having new forms of or new methods with agriculture when they've been used to a certain way. I'm thinking about this because I always pay attention to my local extensions whenever I'm in a different state. So I'm thinking of two different states out west. One of them had a really great kind of regenerative ag kind of philosophy, and the other had a lot more kind of a conventional ag kind of philosophy. And so when I kind of go through and look at what the local extensions are doing, sometimes I look at them and I'm like, ooh, they're not really making a case for, pasture-raised meat or, regenerative agriculture. So I'm just wondering, in your experience, what are some easy, low barrier to entry ways that you encourage yourself or farmers to document why these practices are effective? Or so what are some kind of ways that you measure and think
about
those things?
That's a good question, but the thing I find about farmers is they all look over the fence. They all, and they're not dumb farmers, they're very smart farmers, and they're very interested in finding a way out of the box that they're in. So, they're not quick to just dump their current practice. But, and I've done it with a couple of mainline dairy farmers, 25 years. And, I had one in West Brookfield who, another friend who's a mainline farmer who has been my naysayer for years. He never told me about it, but I heard through the grapevine. He thought I was an idiot. Well, he showed up one day with his friend. He said, "This is my friend Jim. He's been a dairy farmer for 25 years. His wife died of cancer 3 years ago. He's got a new girlfriend. He's looking for maybe what you're doing." So I gave him a pitch. I gave him some books. And on a Thursday, he called me on Monday. He said, "I read all the books." I said, "Well, I got plenty more." He said, "No, I visited your farms this weekend. I'm in. Dairy cows are sold on Wednesday. I bought a fence post pounder. I'm a grass." It was just like that. And I still see him, and he says, "The best decision in my life." And I think when you get people at that point, there's got to be something that wants to make them change. If they're making $1 billion, but see, none of them are. The corn and soy folks are desperate. They're committing suicide. None of the systems are working. Dairy's not working. None of the systems where people are selling to, like the chicken farms where they're just peon slaves, they're not making any money. So the system is badly broken, which I think is one of the opportunities to say, oh, there's a way out. I find people are very interested in that. That's the hope.
Yeah. And I think we have to lift up the success stories. Again, I think the dominant narrative is that you can't make money in farming, that, it's all doom and gloom, there's no way to compete. But I think, we have seen a renaissance in the last decade or so plus of people being, consumers with these food scares and other things, really paying attention. The health crisis is what it is, as Aaron gave the statistics. And so as people wake up to understanding why they're getting sick, what's wrong, what's happened, why we hollowed out rural communities, and start to put all these pieces of the system back together, I think we need to lift up what is working and what provides people with hope and how we can move forward to those values that we have held dear in the past and move in that direction. And then that will hopefully trigger a tsunami of other people reaching out and will change the paradigm of what extension is pushing out. If we see positive examples of that, then I think more people will get behind it. And I think consumers have huge power to shape that, because there's so many more of us.
The ultimate power.
Yes.
And that's what's so frustrating to me, is to be able to tell the story clearly to the customer. Is the whole, it's not the whole game, but it's a whole huge part of it.
And there's so much greenwashing happening right now that is just awful, that we're not
so
doing ourselves any
there.
Favors.
Yeah, and everybody is grass-fed, except for the last 120 days when we feed them a little bit of grain. And we kind of mutter that.
Sure. So one question. First of all, Jen and Rich, thank you so much for this. Amazing what you guys are doing out there to spread the word on pushing more of this. So this one's for you, Jen. And you talked about the community farm and the importance of sustainable agriculture to the public display. How do communities find more of these opportunities? And if they can't find any near their town, how do they help push the town to push for more initiatives like this?
Yeah, I think we're really fortunate here, especially in eastern Massachusetts. Fortunate or unfortunate, right? I don't know which side of the corn some days I'm like, is this a good thing or not? But, you know, the last farm standing, finally people woke up enough to say, well, we better save it. We're not going to have any farms in our town if we don't do something. So I think that's, and now we have a proliferation of community farms in the area because communities have stepped up and done that. It's kind of sad that it was took the last farm to wake them up to say we're going to have a strong ethic of land conservation or a land trust developed or, you know, just town-owned or community-owned support of these properties. But if there is that situation in a community, I mean, it really just takes a group of committed citizens to come together and say this is really important to us and we want to preserve this. Or, you know, even in urban areas, I mean, I'm on the board of the Urban Farming Institute of Boston, and they just created a community land trust for urban agriculture land. So that's another, you know, a big piece of what we can do across the landscape, both rural, peri-urban, and urban communities, is come together with a like-minded group of citizens and say, this is important to us. We want to preserve space and for growing food, and we're going to do it on this scale or, you know, small, medium, large, whatever the scale is, and come together and rally the resources and do that. And support the local farms that still exist so that they can stay in business, so they can pass a good, solid business on to the next generation, and it can continue moving forward so that it doesn't come down to having to save the last farm in a community. But yeah. And I think we're also going to see too, this is like National Cooperative Month, right? October is the month of cooperatives. And I keep, you know, hearing little snippets in the news that the cooperatives are coming back or going to be the next waves. You know, if we can't survive in the capitalist economy, which there's a whole other conversation about systems, then maybe we need to move. I mean, we're seeing this already with the sharing economy, but, you know, do we need to get back into having a lot more cooperatives across many levels, and will that be the way that we can survive, you know, smaller regional scale appropriate farmers can survive by shared land, shared infrastructure, shared market opportunities, shared, you know, branding opportunities, distribution.
Yeah, I think that aggregation model is really, I mean, here, Harvard's a good example. I first called Harvard about selling them meat. The young lady kind of laughed at me. She said, but we use 23,000 pounds a year. I said, fine. Talk to me. I got it. But I have it because I have all these farms as part of our network. As one farm, it'd be like, oh, dead in the water. Can't do it. You know? So that collaboration is huge in dealing with these markets, which are massive.
Well, it is, to Jennifer's point, a connection towards different types of economic models. We are seeing a gig economy changing drastically. Generations growing up on a very different perception of what is next for homeownership, with associated college debt. What do you do next? It's a paradigm shift, as Rich used that term a couple times. And we are looking more towards a circular economy, which we are taking better understanding that this is just not a reductionist approach to everything we do. There are externalities. There are uncalculable expenses that are put into a system that we haven't put on the balance sheet yet, and that seems to be changing, at least from our perspective. Jennifer, where can our listening audience learn more about New Entry? Is there a website that they could find this on?
Sure. You can always go to www.nesfp for New Entry Sustainable Farming Project.org.
And Pete and Jen's Birds?
You can heartoflincoln.org. We'll take you to our ordering page, or codmancommunityfarm.org.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And Rich, how about Big Picture Beef?
BigPicturebeef.com. There's a lot of good stuff there.
Boom. And most of your production and distribution is through larger retailers, larger buyers, and wholesale distribution.
Yeah,
so Big Y, other
Big
grocers?
Big Y, all 70 stores, and Big Y has our product now. Smith College, River Valley Market. We're coming to the Boston area next.
Okay.
But, you know, yeah.
So we've looked at harmonizing with natural systems. We've evaluated better management practice that could be used to produce our food in the future. We've discussed sequestering carbon through re-engaging our living soils on the hoof. We've discussed one of the most undervalued workforce in food production, pollinators. So whether you're a environmentalist, a consumer, a doctor, or really anybody within these systems, this should matter to you, and we should tune in and listen to these conversations. In egress. There we go. Get the last plug in. So, Ridge and Jennifer, thank you so much for partaking in today's conversation. I learned a lot. I hope our audience learned a lot. And I'll just say until next time.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
Thanks for hosting us.
Thank you.